It's Gideon Haig, mumble, bumble, bumble over here.
And it's Peter Lawler over here.
Oh, really?
What sort of an intro is that?
Well, I still haven't quite got it to scan yet. But anyway, in the meantime, you're joining us on Cricket et al., a cricket podcast that's still suffering a bit of a identity hangover. It's since we went into witness protection.
We're transitioning, Gideon.
With our new guys. But
when the hormones kick in, we'll be better.
Anyway, we've been so transformed that we've actually been watching the IPL. What's going on here, Pete?
Well, watching bits and pieces of the IPL, but how can you not? Like everyone else, I am fascinated by this Jake Fraser-McGurk and the fact that they haven't chosen him in the Australian T20 squad, which I kind of could live with maybe, but by God, the selectors escaped a bullet last night.
Okay. All right. Well, let's update us, mate, on the clash between past versus future night last night where the fates set up David Warner and the JFG train to have a face-off in the Capitals game against RCB.
Yeah, that's right, when I don't have the score in front of me. But, of course, David's been absent, hasn't he, for the second half of the tournament with a sore hand.
Yep.
Fraser-McGurk has just been outstanding. He's the only player in the history of IPL to hit 350s in 20 balls or fewer in his career, and his career is half a season. He didn't even play the first few games. And last night, Warner returned. Mm. Imagine Ponting there. Going, it's a difficult situation for Pont.
Yep.
Ponting, Ponter. What's his bloody name? Warner was out second ball. And Fraser-McGurk was flying, absolutely flying, hell-bent on getting another 50 in 15 deliveries or whatever. But after how many of them, Gideon, you got the score in front of you?
21 off 8 or something like that.
Yeah. Run out at the non-striker's end. Deflection off the bowler's hand.
A cruel way.
Yeah. Don't you reckon George Bailey was kind of slightly relieved by that? Because all of Australia would have been talking today and this week about Fraser-McGurk. Had he scored a 50 there or gone off again? I mean, irresistible momentum, Gideon.
Mm. Yeah, I guess the argument is what Warner brings to the setup in terms of his experience and sagacity. There's the fact that the T20 World Cup's taking place in the West Indies, not in India. Things are obviously – it's very, very batter friendly in India at the moment. And of course, they have the impact sub to give the batters the opportunity to really go hard at the top of the innings. That's perfectly played to JFG's strong suit. I think those arguments still stand. But, yeah, look, the player in form versus the player with the established record. It's a story as old as time.
It is, and it's not necessarily Warner or
quite right,
or Fraser-McGurk, but it kind of looks that way, doesn't it? But you've got Head, you've got Warner, you've got Mitch Marsh at the top of the order. Mm. No one's moving for them, and Fraser-McGurk says it himself. Well, I don't know, I don't bat at 5 or 6. I mean, he's had no experience down there, and it's a very different proposition batting down the order to batting at the top of the order. However, Marsh is recovering more slowly than hoped for. Wouldn't be the first time that an injury's got someone into a T20 World Cup.
Indeed.
Yeah. Would you have picked him in the squad?
Would I have picked JFG? Yeah, probably I would have actually.
JFM, mate. Yeah.
I have these issues with the size of squads. I think 15 is a bit anachronistic these days. Considering, I don't really understand why the arbitrary limit of 15 is still followed when teams are kind of constantly in search of matchups and draw on a huge variety of players. Look at the squads in IPL; they're enormous. Why do we have 15 for an international tournament? Almost seems a little bit backward looking.
It makes it difficult, doesn't it? But I guess you're all in the same boat to some degree. I think you're right in that. The World Cup isn't the IPL. Mm. As you say, there's no impact sub. The grounds are going to be different, aren't they? I mean, West Indies, lower, slower, probably more conducive to spin, give bowls a little bit, perhaps a little bit of relief, if not assistance. We don't know what we're going to get in America. I mean, Australians aren't playing there, but as far as the pitches are going, the Manhattan pitch was last seen driving on the back of a lorry from Miami with Damien Howe standing on it with a watering can so it didn't dry out on the journey. They've never done this before. They've never prepared a pitch that far from the ground. Generally, you prepare a cricket pitch 120 metres from the ground at most. This one's, how far is Miami to New York? 2,000 kilometres.
Far enough, yeah.
Far enough for it to be a long drive and for it to be a different climate.
And the bizarre thing is that they're leaving no legacy behind too. The ground's not going to be, you know, a week after the tournament's over, they'll have packed up and gone home. They're leaving nothing behind for US cricket. This idea that somehow it was going to, you know, leave a great trace on the American sporting landscape. Now, I think it's still subject to challenge.
$35 million temporary stadium. $35 million is peanuts for a stadium, isn't it? Tell you what, though, there's an opportunity there. Keep your eye on eBay. Mm. You wouldn't mind picking up a drop-in pitch. If you're looking for a drop-in pitch and you live in Manhattan or nearby, there's your opportunity.
We should explain that. You can give it the once-over, Pete, because you're actually on your way there. We should explain to listeners that Pete is next week going to be heading off to the US for a busman's holiday.
I am. Yeah, that's right. Well, I'm just going over there for a bit of fun, but cricket's on in New York, so I've got to go and do that, don't I? I mean, you complained all our life about cricket not being played in places like New York. So I think it's going to be fascinating. Problem is, my accreditation's been rejected. Gideon, we have no standing in the cricket community as podcasters.
Okay, all right. This is it you hanging around with me too often?
It's an unnerving development, but apparently it's because I was too late putting it in. But that's okay.
It will work itself out, Pete.
I do want to be there for the India-Pakistan game.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, in New York. That's going to be a bit of fun, I think. I'm going to have a lot of fun, actually, over there. Hey, the other thing that was going on in the IPL that you mentioned in your 10 things number 9 – on the Substack is this Sanjeev Goenka giving KL Rahul quite the dressing down on the boundary line. Wasn't a good look, mate.
Yeah, no, it was a visible dressing down too. I mean, you know, who knows what happens in close quarters between owners and players and coaches. That's always happening out of sight. I actually don't mind it happening in plain sight. It might as well. Sunlight is the best disinfectant. I like the possibility that that the owner really cared. He wasn't just standing by to cream a profit out of the IPL. He was animated by that performance by Lucknow Super Giants, and they were bloody hopeless. They were absolutely awful. They were beaten by 10 wickets inside 10 overs. If Goenka wasn't pissed off about that, then he was in the wrong business. So he has a crack at Rahul. At Rahul, who's batted like he was in a coma, captained them like he was in a coma because they bowled an absolute shower of shit. But the strange thing is that in India, no one will speak up for Goenka. No one will say, "Oh, well, he's within his rights as an owner to be agitated about this." No. Indian players are such a protected species that the idea that anyone would raise a voice against them. Is just regarded as an appalling breach of politesse.
Well, clearly, you want the IPL to be like an episode of The Apprentice. You want a sort of Donald Trump type figure wandering onto the ground and saying, "You're fired."
I want owners like Don King.
He could have done it behind closed doors, though.
He could have, but why should he? He owns the joint. Have a crack.
They were dreadful.
They deserved public humiliation after that performance. And I said in the Substack, the more the IPL looks like just a machine for the generation of profits, the less appealing it is to me. I want it to feel like it matters. I want more owners losing their temper. After all, it's their money. Why shouldn't they have the capacity to go straight to the top and make their feelings known?
It's an interesting take. I mean, we've always sort of – I've spoken to a few IPL coaches and people involved in the IPL about what it's like dealing with the owners. Mm. And something somebody said to me today, there's only one coach who hasn't moved on in the history of the IPL in recent times. That's Stephen Fleming.
Yeah, interesting.
Shows you to a degree how intense it is. It's a very competitive environment. But, I mean, some of those owners, they get involved in selection.
Yeah.
You think that's okay?
Well, you know, they're
my toys, yeah.
They're bound to when a team fails because so much is at stake.
Oh, no, there are some owners who insist on a meeting with the coaches on the evening before the game and to talk through selection.
Well, there's all sorts of strange taboos, aren't there? There are proprietors, I think, who are guided by numerology, aren't they, where selections are concerned. Wasn't that the story with Srinivasan, that he used to contact his religious guru to talk about the makeup of the side?
Oh, well, that's acceptable. Yeah. So, they do the same thing for marriage.
So why not have it out in the open? Why have these things happen surreptitiously? Is it merely the fact that he did it publicly rather than he did it privately?
Well, it was humiliating for old mate.
Well, yeah, but the match was humiliating for him. Well, he should have felt humiliated. Anyway, the protective cordon forming around Rahul and this idea that, oh, heaven forfend, he might actually leave the franchise.
Mm.
Well, frankly, after a performance like that, he'd be lucky to get a job elsewhere.
There you go. Yep. Well, we still don't have JFM in the squad yet, but I don't know. I'm not giving up hope on that front. I reckon he might somehow worm his way in there. I think one of the spots that I had identified for him, there's a possibility it was Cameron Green's spot in the lead-up to naming the squad.
Yeah.
But Green's had a MOM performance last night, Gideon.
It's amazing.
Or POM.
It can change in an hour, can't it? Our impression of how players are going, and we've only got another week of home and aways, don't we? And then and then we get to the finals.
Form is the only thing that matters.
Momentum
in T20 cricket, I reckon.
I don't know. Form to me is kind of a weird concept in T20. If you get out first ball one day, and you get 50 the next day, are you in form or out of form? I think
might be a bit too early to tell, but so if you've had 350s in a row, you're hot.
So much of it is random, though, and the gap between success and failure is so small. Anyway, we can say that RCB do have the wind in their sails after having their horror start. They lost 6 on the bounce, didn't they, at the top, and they've now won 5 on the bounce. Will Jacks getting that 100 against the Titans? That was probably a bit of a turning point for them. Although Virat's innings against the Punjab Kings, that 92, he was absolutely fantastic. And I think there's now a lobby, isn't there, in India for Virat opening in the T20 World Cup with Rohit as a result of his IPL form.
When Virat goes off in
T20, it just looks fantastic. Because
you
really are reminded that you're actually watching cricket, and a supremely adaptable cricketing specimen in Virat. He's just extraordinary the way he can migrate between the different formats.
All's right in India when Virat's flying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Paddy Cummins' team's done pretty well too. It's been a very good tournament for them. They're a pretty good chance for the finals, aren't they? Are you looking at the table right now?
I think they're in the four, aren't they, with KKR and the Royals and the perennial CSK?
Because they've been bottom dwellers for a few years, you know, and the change is essentially not much, but you know, that Cummins and Head have driven that to a degree. Head's been outstanding.
Well, Sunrisers have struggled since Warner left, basically, haven't they? I think they've really struggled to rebuild their identity. And Pat Cummins has been surprisingly good for a guy who doesn't actually captain, of course, Australia in T20 cricket.
Is he at the World Cup.
No, exactly.
Oh. I like that. I like the fact that you can kind of say, yeah, go on, you drive the car. I'll just sit in the passenger seat and stare out the window for a while. I'm not connecting that back to you, Gideon.
No. Pat Cummins is at a terrific tournament. He seems to be leading a very cheerfully blended dressing room. He seems to have a good relationship with his owner. and his coach. He seems maybe he's bringing some learnings from his from blending a diverse dressing room for Australia. We'll see. Anyway, shall we take a break, Pete, and come back in a moment on Cricket Etc. with more to discuss from the world of cricket? Why not? Let's do that. And we're back on Cricket et al., which I think before the break I referred to as Cricket Etc. So I lose the gamble as to who would dead name the podcast first, but that's because I talk so much, Pete. I'm bound to stray into indiscretion. Anyway, the other big development of the week is that we have a distinguished passing. He hasn't died, but James Anderson has announced that the Lord's Test match against West Indies will be his last, which gives us the opportunity to rove over his great career, of which we have watched a lot. Pete, favourite Jimmy Anderson memories?
Well, just before we go on, I love the fact that you've absolved yourself of that heinous error leading into the break. We'll get legal letters. I love the fact that they actually had to track him down and say, mate, it's time to stop. Mm. He was ready to keep playing. They had to intervene. Yeah, yeah. There was an intervention and said, Jimmy, you're going to be 42 soon, mate. Yeah, it's time to give it up. 41 years old. Yeah. How does a medium pace bowler, fast bowler, play that long, that many tests, 187 tests? And part of it, he's very light on his feet, isn't he?
He's
not one of those sort of heavy at the crease bowlers. I think I heard somebody say the other day, Usman Khawaja says, you can't hear him approaching. It's a little bit like Mikey Holding.
But the real reason is not that he's 41 years old. It's that he's taken 25 wickets in his last 10 test matches and that he's struggled for penetration over the last 2 years. If he was still sniffing out wickets the way that he had been in the 3 or 4 years before then, there's probably no reason why he wouldn't go on. But he hasn't looked like the same bowler. He's looked like a, you know, it's like the constant playing of a familiar favourite tune that has begun to pour. And the reason that he's gone on for so long is because basically he's been a test matches only player. He hasn't been playing any of the other formats. It's pretty easy to maintain your fitness record if it's not being constantly tested. And he was on good money. Let's face it, for a guy who was playing test matches only, those contracts were actually pretty lucrative. Why give that up if you don't absolutely have to?
Gideon, do you think he ranks among the world's greatest bowlers?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in some senses, the kind of the last of his kind, in the sense that he only ever played for his county and for England. He hasn't played in any of the overseas leagues. He's a breath of cricket in a former time. He's maintained very, very high professional standards and demands the best of himself. And he's actually, you know, I think he's been through lots of phases of this England team. He's seen them come. He's seen them go. If you look at his record, it's remarkable how much he accomplished for Joe Root. 170 wickets at 21 under Joe Root's captaincy, which is pretty amazing considering how poorly England were travelling at that time.
He was very good then, wasn't he? He a very consistent performer, you know, at home and abroad. He was good, you know, he wasn't one of these guys who went to water in India. In fact, he was quite an effective bowler in India. Perhaps his soft spot was Australia. Home and abroad, his average blows out against Australia. In fact, I think his numbers were worse at home than here. They were always affected by that. His introduction to Test cricket at a very young age, weren't they, where he was really blasted by Australia in those first Tests.
He was flogged.
It was the first one at Brisbane, wasn't it?
2006-7, he was absolutely
when Ponting got the 196. Yeah, that was the first time we saw him, and I think he got something like 1 for 195 in that Test match. Yeah. And then I remember it was something similar at Adelaide as well, wasn't it? And but he improved in the third test. But he's quite a different bowler in those days too. He hadn't matured. He hadn't developed. He was still that sort of tear away.
He was bowling swing fast.
Bowler, wasn't
he? He was trying to bowl fast. Yeah.
And trying to swing the crap out of it. And he kind of backed away from that later in life and became far more consistent.
I think one of the really interesting things about him is, if you break his record down, his record in England wins is 380 wickets at 19, 86 England wins, and 186 wickets at 37 in defeats. So he was a leading indicator of English performance. You know, if Anderson clicked, then England did click. The other thing about his record in defeats, there's probably never a guy who has appeared at the end of so many England test losses, because he was often the last man dismissed. this endless image of Jimmy Anderson shaking hands with opponents, with one stump left standing.
Because he was an abject batter as well. You talk about him being old school. He was the old school fast bowler, with a bat in hand. Yeah.
But he was a very good fielder, actually. He was a very good catcher. He was very mobile, very athletic in the field, and he maintained that standard. He dropped some catches, though, last year in the Ashes, Pete, which you might remember. And I remember thinking, geez, Jimmy doesn't drop too many. And when he was dropping them, he was looking really disgusted, like the game was telling him something. Maybe the game wasn't telling him something loudly enough, but he did look like a man who was staving off Anno Domini last summer in England.
He was kind of hard to warm to, wasn't he? He was that old school northern curmudgeon. He gave you nothing.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about off the field. Do you recall bumping into him at the hotel reception desk in Manchester?
Yeah.
And from my memory, there were two other players with him, and, g'day, and you go to say hello to Jimmy, he just turns his back and walks away.
Unlike, say, Mark Wood, who would, say g'day to anyone.
Anyone, Jimmy never gave you the time.
Jimmy
of day.
Didn't give you much, but Jimmy, I think, was a pretty shy man.
I think you're right. He is
and a
shy.
Very, and a very local man. I think the guy still has this very, very close association with Burnley Cricket Club, his original cricket club. He's actually talking about turning out for Burnley now that his England career is over. He's his best friends, his longest running friends, are those who he originally played club cricket with. I think he's just outwardly very guarded. And like I said, he never played in any of those domestic leagues, so he never really interacted with any of those players who were his opponents. You could never imagine Jimmy having a cheery word with David Warner, could you?
No.
So
no, but he was one of those guys you had developed an opinion of their personality from what you saw on the field.
Which I didn't
mind. Much else. I don't mind that either. Yeah. Alistair Cook said that they would have long evenings together in hotel rooms and not say a word.
Yeah.
It's not like you and I, mate.
Isn't the story that they went on their first tour together, and the only time that Cook had ever played against Anderson had abused the hell out of him, and I think Cookie introduced himself to Jimmy Anderson by saying, "The last time we met, you called me a cunt."
Word, get in.
Well, they mended fences, and they in some senses, Cookie is even more of a pair with Anderson than Stuart Broad.
Yeah,
they played so much together, top and tail of that England effort. International cricket was the sum of them. They gave the impression of really, really valuing playing for their country, and I applaud that. I appreciate that wherever I see it. And it seems, of course, Cook continued to play, didn't he, in county cricket after he stopped playing international cricket. I wouldn't be surprised to see Anderson doing the same.
Yeah, I think you might be right about that. Although, he's always harboured ambitions to be a fashion designer.
Is that
In fact,
right?
He's had his own – he even studied his own clothesline up, if you know what I mean by clothesline. Line of clothes. Not a hill's hoist. Which is really curious, isn't it? For a guy, I think he's married to a woman in the fashion industry.
Yeah, so she's a model. Yeah,
there's little curious things that I've noted about him along the journey. There was one other one too. That's right. When he remember he posed naked in a gay magazine?
I remember that. Yes, you're right.
I found that fascinating. And he went, "Whoa," and he says, "Oh, well, I've got no problems with that. And, you know, and he said, and if that means any, it makes any male gay cricketers feel better about themselves, well, I'm good. I liked that. It was very not northern.
Yeah.
Well, you never, northerners never take their clothes off. It's too freaking cold.
And the other thing I liked about him was he worked as the, he was the executive producer, wasn't he, on that documentary that Barney Douglas did back in 2015 about the Maasai cricketers.
And I can
remember that because I went to the opening night of that. Barney had a, had a few of us along. It's a terrific documentary, actually, if you get a chance to catch up with it. And Jimmy was there. And, you know, clearly a lot of people turned up excited about seeing Jimmy there, but Jimmy was clearly quite uncomfortable with the attention that he was getting because he felt, I think he felt rightly, that the attention should be on Barney, who was the creative spirit behind that that documentary. I kind of liked that about him. And it did leave me with that impression that Jimmy was quite a tribal person. Jimmy's tribe were Northing, was North England cricket, and he remained fanatically loyal to it and kind of understood it, worked with the grain of that.
I marked him hard over that George Bailey incident. Picking on George in his first test, standing over him, bullying him like that.
Well, yet another moment when Jimmy was the last man out. I actually quite like a guy who's prepared to dish out a bit of stick when he's just about to be absolutely pantsed by the opposition.
Death before
dishonour.
Michael Clark turns around and says, "There you go, Mitch. Get him." very quickly after that, yeah. Gee, that can't have been much fun batting in, being a tail ender in that series when Mitchell Johnson, because that was almost criminal, that short bowling at the tail in that series.
Nothing was fun about batting in that series if you
were. Those men are heroes just going out there with a bat in their hand, frankly. Yeah. I'd have found an excuse.
Like Piers Morgan.
Hey?
Like Piers Morgan.
Piers.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
That's right. He did do that, didn't he? Brett Lee. Yeah. That was a gutsy effort from Piers Morgan facing up. He had broken bones. Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Brett Lee out trying to kill you, running through the crease.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd have lasted one delivery.
Deserved all he got.
Oh, I'm not saying he didn't deserve it, but I'm just saying it still showed some remarkable courage. No common sense, but anyway. Hello, Piers.
We'll be back in a moment on Cricket Et Al, and we've got a special retirement tribute to James Anderson, our favourite Dua Lancastrian, or second favourite, actually, after Mike E. Smith. Back in a moment on Cricket Et Al. And we're back on Cricket Et Al, and, of course, the ultimate tribute that we can bestow on any cricketer or cricket personality is that we... Pete, what do?
We do a top 10
in
their honour.
We do a top 10 in their honour.
Oh, is Jimmy going to get – yeah, he's the subject of this week's top 10.
It is.
That's excellent, isn't it?
10 songs inspired by the saga of James Anderson's career. Pete, would you like to start?
I've seen James Anderson lip syncing with a couple of those English media boys. Yeah. He's doing quite a good job of it.
What was the song?
Well, oh, do I have to say it?
Go on.
Final Countdown. possibly one of the worst songs ever recorded.
Although covered by Laybark. Have you heard the Laybark cover of Final Countdown?
No.
It's ace.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Look it up.
I'll take
a
look at it.
Check it out.
I'm going topical. I'm tying a few things together. You'll see what I've done here. I'm going with that Australian cover of I'm Not Like Everybody Else by... Jimmy and the Boys.
Well, how timely, Pete. How timely.
Yeah,
why is it timely?
Because Ignatius Jones.
Indeed.
Who was a member of Iggy and the Boys. Mm-hmm. Jimmy and the Boys, sorry.
Iggy.
Singing
the Stooges.
Last week.
Yeah.
He is no longer. He was a great guy. I really liked him.
On the same day as Steve Albini.
He did too. Yeah. Very different musical careers because Ignatius Jones was the musical director at Dolly Parton World.
Yes.
After he was in music. And then he got picked up. He was involved in that whole opening ceremony of
the Sydney Harbour.
I think he was the horse guy, and then they did a horse show of that.
Yeah.
He used to drink at the Aurora Hotel with a group of us back in the day.
He was
a nice fella.
He was born and died in the Philippines.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. He had a very interesting life, I think.
Indeed.
His sister was a singer on Play School or something, wasn't she? Monica. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I'm going for Longtime Man,
particularly
the Nick Cave cover version from The First Born Is Dead. Fantastic song. And a fantastic climax to a wonderful album.
It's a really, really good album, isn't it? That's a good call. Who did that originally? Long Time Man.
Johnny Cash.
Was it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Anyway, the Cave version is definitive.
Really?
Yeah.
Now, I'm fumbling around now. I'm padding because I don't think I've written a name for this.
Would you like me to do another one?
Oh, no, I'll just find another one. Oh, I've got one.
Yeah?
Get Ready.
Go on.
Yeah. I don't know. Why did I choose that? I can't even remember why I've chosen it now. By the Temptations and Smokey Robinson.
Yeah. And the Miracles.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And why have I chosen that?
What's the song?
Get Ready, Get Ready. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
Jeez. Should we edit this out? This is absolutely hopeless.
No, when in doubt,
I've had a moment.
Just plow on.
Oh, I know why. I can admit this now. Because I had that song, People Get Ready Because a Train Is Coming, you know, about just waiting and waiting in my head. But, of course, that's not that song, is it? It's a different song. Yeah.
Anyway, that's perfect.
Thanks.
Totally random.
At least no one's listening, are they?
Yeah.
Anyway, we went to ad breaks last week, there was no – we didn't go anywhere. We just –
Oh, right.
We're just immediately back. But
okay, well, you've got to have a Marquee Smith song, and I was trying to think of four songs that seem to evoke the spirit of Jimi Anderson. And I've ended up with "I Feel Voxish" from "Perverted by Language," because he was constantly voxish, especially early in his career. James, he was never short of a word. And I've always liked that made up Marquee Smith word, voxish. I feel voxish.
Well, yeah, that's fair enough. But he didn't really come from Preston. He came from 20 kilometres away from Preston, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah, in Burnley, which of course is the home of Chumbawamba.
Chumbawamba, yeah.
Chumbawamba. All four members of Chumbawamba come from Burnley.
Yeah, but don't forget that the Fall did the Kicker Conspiracy video at Burnley Football Club. So there is a connection, however tenuous.
Oh, that's not bad.
Okay.
Yeah. No, that's not so tenuous given the non-connections I'm making at the moment. But anyway, Tub Thumper, I Get Down, what is it? I Get Knocked Down and I Get Up Again, whatever that song is by Chumbawamba.
That's right.
They're from Jimmy's hometown. I looked up a bit about Jimmy's hometown. Jeez, it sounds like it. Yeah. The highlights, according to Wiki, is the 20 entertainment highlights in Burnley.
Yep.
24-lane indoor bowling centre.
Wow.
9-screen cinema.
Yeah.
With 3 3D screens. That was opened in the 90s, so it might be a bit worn out now. And they've got a local theatre. It sounds like a great place, doesn't it? They are the three highlights of Burnley, according to Wikipedia.
I'm not going to do Burnley down. If it's good enough for Jimmy, it's good enough for me.
A movie was set in Burnley, Bank of Dave. You ever come across that movie about a guy called
vaguely,
Dave who sets up a bank?
Yeah.
That's set in Burnley,
if you
remember.
Yeah.
We might have to go to Burnley next, Ashes.
I think so. Mm. We're overdue a pilgrimage. My next song is a Gang of Four song. With Alison Mosshart, England's In My Bones. Because it was in his bones. He was the quintessential international cricketer for whom there was no higher honour than representing his own country. Hats off.
Beatles, Mean Mr. Mustard Seed. Because I think he was kind of mean.
He was a bit mean. Yeah.
He was, yeah. He was begrudging. Yeah. Well, you said he's shy, and he is shy, but he came across as mean.
Yeah, taciturn, aloof sometimes. But the thing that I remember about him very strongly is he had this habit. Okay, so he would bowl the ball, and he would immediately run his fingers through his hair. Do you remember that? How he would and how he would replace his forelock, which had fallen down in the effort of his follow through, and it actually made me think of my next song, which is "Never Fight a Man with a Perm" by Idols. And I happen to know, that Felix White, who's a great mate of Jimmy Anderson's, is an Idols fan because we have
good band.
It's a great band. A great
touring
band.
This summer, I think
they are indeed. They are indeed.
We should go.
Yeah.
Boney M. Jimmy. Have you ever heard that song?
Nice. Yeah, very nice.
Have you ever heard it?
Yes,
I have.
You're
blessed if you haven't.
Yep.
Jimmy, I would like to drive your car. But there you go. It was actually being covered by, who else covered it? Tones and I think.
Yeah. Okay, yep.
Oh, no, Tones and I had a song called Jimmy. It's not the same song. And Tool have a song called Jimmy as well. It's not bad.
Okay, that would be a very different song in the hands of Tool. Mm. Okay, my last one, Rocky Erickson, 13th Floor Elevators, You're Gonna Miss Me. From the Psychedelic Sounds at the 13th Floor Elevators. What a great band.
Interesting band, aren't they?
They are.
Mm. Or were.
Yeah, well, anyway, still are on my Spotify list anyway.
Anyway.
Is that all we've got time for on Cricket et al.?
That was a bit rusty. That was a bit rusty by me. You've just fallen straight back into it. I'm struggling. I don't know what's going on here.
We'll get there. We'll be match fit by the time the T20 World Cup comes along. You're off next week, Pete. Look forward to speaking to you just preparatory to your departure. We'll be covering the T20 World Cup in due course and look forward to your company then. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from me on Cricket et al.
And it's good night from him.